And a happy birthday today to Rex Bright of Bondurant and to Bobby D. Gregory of Hampton. Happy birthday to Rex and Bobby. You are joined on your birthday today by actor Al Pacino, who turns 84, actor Talia Shire, who turns 78, and actor Renee Zellweger, who turns 55. So happy birthday to everyone who's celebrating a birthday, whether we were able to read your name or not. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call. We're at 515-243-6833. We would like to get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now, here's Linda with today's obituaries.
From Des Moines, Sandra Lee Sandy Wagner, beloved mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and friend, passed peacefully on April 19th in Des Moines at the age of 82. She was born on August 28th, 1941, in Waterloo, Iowa, and graduated from Tripoli High School in Iowa in 1959. Following high school, Sandy worked as a telephone operator before attending Baptist Bible College in Johnston City, New York. It was at BBC where she met Bernard Lee Bernie Payne from Brookfield, Missouri. They were married on June 2, 1962. She and her husband served the Lord together faithfully for over 50 years as pastor and pastor's wife in Oswego, New York, Des Moines, Perry, and Newton, Iowa, and then having 19 years of ministry on the beautiful island of Bermuda. Sandy enjoyed her years teaching Sunday school as well as many Bible study fellowship women's groups. Sandy will be treasured and remembered as one who loved and served her Savior, Jesus Christ, a wife who faithfully supported her beloved husband for 53 years, a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother who continually prayed for her family. She was so very proud of each of them, and she made them each feel special in their own unique way. Sandy was an incredible woman who encouraged so many with her sweet smile, her kind words, serving actions, and faithful correspondence to friends and family. Sandy is the mother of three children: Jonathan, partner Kimberly Payne; David, partner Chantel Payne; and Joanna, partner Benjamin Brightman. She is grandmother to seven grandchildren: Kristen, partner Jody Strupp; Jessica, partner Ron Lieptine; Mariah, partner Alex Clark; Jackson Payne, Shalem Payne, Brianna Brightman, and Simone Brightman; great-grandmother to Grayson Clark, Hayden Clark, and Brixton Clark. She is survived by her sister Lois Wagner and brothers Mike, partner Claire Wagner; Kim, partner Mary Wagner; brothers-in-law Larry, partner Kathy Payne; and Roger, partner Cindy Payne, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. Sandy was preceded in death by her husband, Bernie Payne, granddaughter, Brianna Brightman, her parents, Roger and Verna Wagner, mother and father-in-law, Lawrence and Wilhelmina Juliana Payne, brother Gerald, brothers-in-law, Edward Payne, Orville, partner Kathy Payne, and sister-in-law, Evelyn Davis. The words of Proverbs 31, verses 26 to 31, best describe the life so well lived by Sandy Payne. This is the quotation: "She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children arise and called her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Honor her for all that her hands have done, and let her works bring her praise. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 27th, at Grace Church in Des Moines. A Facebook live broadcast will begin at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, on the Pence Reese Funeral Home and Cremation Services Facebook page. The family will greet friends from 10 to 11 a.m. at the church. And our other one is Norvaline Gordon Mesh of Des Moines went to be with her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, on Tuesday, April 9th, at the age of 95, after a short stay in Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines. A memorial service will be held at Henderson's Funeral and Cremation Care on Saturday, April 27th at 1 p.m. with Reverend Cooley officiating. A private family burial will take place at a later date.
And returning now to the Metro and Iowa section, the county rehires a medical examiner. Polk County has rehired a medical examiner who was abruptly fired more than 4 years ago over a personnel issue. Dr. Gregory Schmunk was rehired in April as an associate medical examiner with the Polk County Medical Examiner's Office to perform autopsies. The Polk County Board of Supervisors voted to approve his 2-year contract April 9 in a 3-1 vote. Supervisor Matt McCoy voted no, and Supervisor Robert Brownell was absent, according to meeting minutes. Schmunk started this work this week, according to Polk County Administrator John Norris. Schmunk, who previously served as a county medical examiner for about 16 years, was abruptly fired in early 2020, with the county citing what it called an apparent lack of oversight related to ongoing personnel issues at the time. It was subsequently revealed that county supervisors agreed to pay $200,000 to settle a lawsuit from a 2017 applicant for a job in the medical examiner's office who ultimately was not hired. James Sargent, who alleged he was turned down for the job because of his sexual orientation, filed the lawsuit against Schmunk and a former chief investigator, Amanda Lewick, who was also fired. After the county settled, Schmunk contacted Reader's Watchdog, part of the Des Moines Register, to provide Sargent's civil rights complaint, a memo detailing the outcome of an internal human resources investigation into his office, as well as an employee's audio recording of him, Lewick and other employees discussing Sargent and other job applicants. At the time, he hoped to show that he and Lewick were not what he called anti-gay. A timeline contained in Sargent's lawsuit shows managers' terminations came just after Sargent filed a discrimination complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, a step that precedes a formal civil rights lawsuit like the one he later filed in district court. On Tuesday, Norris told the Des Moines Register the county is capitalizing on Schmunk's skills to fill a gap at the medical examiner's office, given a national shortage of forensic pathologists. Schmunk has no administrative or management responsibilities in his new role, Norris said. The bottom line is that we can't do one person, one forensic pathologist. We have a load for 2 full-time forensic pathologists at our county medical examiner's office, he said. But he is an excellent forensic pathologist, Norris said of Schmunk. Law enforcement was extremely pleased we brought him back in. He's on several national boards for forensic pathologists, help write some of the practices and procedures they follow nationally. So we're really fortunate to get his expertise back in the lab. Schmunk did not immediately return a call for comment on Tuesday. When asked by the Register if there were concerns about toxicity in the workplace with Schmunk's return, a remark some county examiner employees previously made, Norris responded there were none. He reiterated Schmunk will not be working in an administrative capacity. The hire is a cost-saving measure for taxpayers, Norris added. The county currently has a staffing capacity for 2 forensic pathologists that conduct an average of 500 autopsies annually. For over a year, the county board has been contracting with the state to provide about 250 autopsies annually due to one forensic pathology's vacancy in the county's office. The state charges a base fee of $1,900 per autopsy, according to Norris, which equates to about $475,000 or more per year. Under the new contract, Schmunk's annual base salary is $260,000. If Schmunk conducts more than the industry standard of 252 autopsies in his first year, he'll get an additional $1,200 for each autopsy performed, according to the contract. Norris said the county, for a short time, was without any pathologists following the exit of chief medical examiner Dr. Joshua Akers in 2022, who was tapped to lead after Schmunk's firing. After Akers left, the county contracted with the state medical examiner to perform all autopsies. The county hired Dr. Joseph Blitman as chief medical examiner in October of 2023, who has since been working full-time. Norris said hiring Schmunk will enable the county to bring all of the autopsy exams back in-house.
This is our last little story from the Metro section. Police investigating after a body pulled from the Des Moines River. An investigation is underway after a body was found in the Des Moines River on Wednesday morning, police said. The Des Moines Police Department was dispatched to the south bank of the Des Moines River, east of 2nd Avenue, at about 9 a.m., said Des Moines Police Department spokesperson Sergeant Paul Parisek. A witness told investigators he spotted the body in the river, Parisek said. Officers sent out the Metro Star dive team to recover the body, which appears to be an adult man, Parisek said. Investigators do not suspect foul play in the person's death, though the investigation is ongoing. Des Moines Police Department detectives are being assisted by the Des Moines Police Department Crime Scene Investigation Unit and the Polk County Medical Examiner's Office. More information will be shared as it becomes available, Parisek said.
And that concludes the Metro and Iowa section. We'll return now to the front page section, which includes this additional Iowa story. Are your allergies worse? Iowa currently has one of the highest pollen rates in the U.S. Can't stop sneezing? It could be because Iowa has some of the worst pollen levels in the country right now. Spring came earlier this year, and so did allergies. Many flowers bloomed earlier than usual, creating a longer allergy season. Des Moines is ranked 8th among the most challenging places to live with seasonal allergies. Nearly 81 million people in the U.S. suffer from seasonal allergies, according to the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. The entire state was what was called high allergy levels by that organization and pollen count, according to pollen.com. Plants, trees, and grass release pollen in the spring to fertilize other plants of the same species. The powdery particles drift in the air and are easily inhaled. For some people, inhaling pollen causes their immune system to overreact. The immune system sees the pollen as a danger and releases antibodies that attack the allergens. That leads to the release of histamines into the blood. Histamines, in turn, trigger runny noses, itchy eyes, and other allergy symptoms. Allergies are likely to be difficult all year long. Iowa is expecting some rainfall in the summer months, which is needed for the drought, but will come at a cost to those who suffer from allergies. This will create humidity, which can create mold-triggered allergies, according to the Weather Channel. Climate warming has also contributed to lengthening allergy season since 1970. Higher levels of carbon dioxide can boost pollen production in plants such as grasses and ragweed, according to Climate Central. The outlet reported that the U.S. could face up to a 200% increase in pollen production by the end of this century due to high levels of CO2 production. So how to fight allergies when pollen counts are high? Reducing exposure is one method to reduce allergies. The Mayo Clinic also recommends these four steps. First, stay indoors on dry and windy days and go out right after it rains, which helps clear the pollen. Change out of clothes that you've worn outside and shower to remove pollen from your body. While inside, try to keep the air clean. And finally, dehumidifiers can help dry out your home, which can provide some benefits.
New U.S. rules crack down on airlines' hidden fees. The Department of Transportation announced new rules on Wednesday to better protect airline passengers against costly surprise airline fees, the agency said. As part of the Biden-Harris administration's efforts to crack down on corporate ripoffs, two new air travel rules were finalized. The rules mandate that airlines pay full refunds in a timely and straightforward manner and ensure transparency regarding fees associated with air travel. The new regulations are expected to save consumers over $500 million each year in hidden junk fees, the DOT said. Passengers deserve to know up front what costs they are facing and should get their money back when an airline owes them without having to ask, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg said in a statement. Today's announcements will require airlines to both provide passengers better information about costs before ticket purchase and promptly provide cash refunds to passengers when they are owed, not only saving passengers time and money, but also preventing headaches. The first new regulation will simplify the process for airline passengers to get what they're owed by requiring airlines to give automatic cash refunds. Passengers can get these refunds when their flights are canceled or significantly changed, their checked bags are significantly delayed, or the ancillary services like Wi-Fi they purchased are not provided, the announcement said. The second will require airlines and ticket agents to be upfront about any hidden fees, such as checking a bag or changing a flight, to help consumers avoid unneeded or unexpected charges that can quickly increase and add significant cost to what may at first look like a cheap ticket. Airline fees, increasingly common for airlines to boost their profit, have grown confusing for passengers. Both rules will go into effect in about 6 months or around the end of October, the agency said. Getting a refund from airlines is a lengthy and often complicated process. Sometimes passengers end up getting a travel credit or voucher instead of an actual reimbursement or just a partial refund. Under the new regulation, refunds will be much more straightforward. Airlines must promptly provide automatic refunds without passengers explicitly requesting them, and the refunds must be issued in the original payment method used to make the purchase. Airlines will have 7 business days to make full refunds for credit card purchases and 20 calendar days for other payment methods. It can be tricky to know exactly how much your final airline ticket will cost due to hidden fees. What may look like a low price at first can quickly add up. Airlines will now have to disclose any baggage, change, and cancellation fees and policies before purchases are made, and it has to be clear and upfront, not hidden behind a hyperlink. Airlines will also need to be transparent about weight and dimension limitations. Third-party websites such as Expedia or Booking.com will also be required to display this information. These days, it's common for people to pay for seat selection, especially for the lowest price fares, but carriers will now need to inform consumers that seats are guaranteed and it's unnecessary to pay for one. The DOT is also banning airlines from using bait-and-switch tactics, in which an airline advertises a discounted fare that doesn't include mandatory fees that drive the ticket price up.
Biden signs a $95 billion foreign aid bill. This is Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden on Wednesday signed into law a $95 billion foreign aid bill that will funnel $60 billion to Ukraine, $17 billion to Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and elsewhere, and $8 billion for allies in the Indo-Pacific. It gives vital support to America's allies so they can defend themselves against threats to their sovereignty and the lives and freedoms of their citizens, Biden said from the White House. It's an investment in our own security because when our allies are stronger, and I want to make this point again and again, we are stronger, Biden said. After 6 months, the wrinkle of election year politics and the threat of a House leadership coup, the Senate on Tuesday approved the package with a bipartisan 79-18 vote. It also includes legislation that would force TikTok's Chinese parent company to divest from the social media app or face an effective ban in the United States. Unlike in the House, where lawmakers voted for each of the provisions independently, senators had to cast a single vote for or against all of the provisions combined. Today, the Senate sends a unified message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy, and it's our of need, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, said on the Senate floor Tuesday. Tuesday's vote concluded a lengthy debate across both chambers of Congress that reflected shifting attitudes within the GOP about the United States' role in the world, pitting Republican leaders against their own rank-and-file members, and at times the de facto leader of the party, former President Donald Trump. Many Republicans in both chambers voted against aid to Ukraine, which has been fighting back against a Russian invasion since February of 2022. Opponents of additional aid argue the U.S. has already done enough to help Ukraine and the taxpayer funds would be better spent on domestic priorities or paying down the nation's estimated $1.5 trillion budget deficit. Proponents of the foreign aid framed it as an investment that would keep the country out of a war, that a victory in Ukraine would prompt Russian President Vladimir Putin to attack European allies that the U.S. is sworn to defend under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They eventually prevailed as Republicans and Democrats came together to pass the aid. This is an important day for America and a very important day for freedom-loving countries around the world, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican of Kentucky, said Tuesday. I think we've turned the corner on the isolationist movement, he said. I think we've made some progress, and I think it's going to have to continue because we've got big problems, China, Russia, Iran. You could argue that this is a more challenging time right now than it was leading up to World War II, he said. Several Senate Republicans voted in favor of the legislation despite voting against it when the Senate considered the package in February. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican of Oklahoma, was one of those who switched his vote. He said he and a group of other conservative senators began working with former President Donald Trump and Republican leadership in both chambers to come up with a package that more Republicans could support. Provisions to make around $9.5 billion in aid to Ukraine alone instead of a grant and to seize Russian foreign assets to fund Ukraine's fight were part of that, he said. Trump posted on Truth Social last week that Ukraine's survival is important to the U.S. despite long-held public skepticism of Ukraine aid. House Speaker Mike Johnson resisted the foreign aid package for months, but ended up playing a pivotal role in advancing the legislation at the risk of his job. Multiple hard-right lawmakers have threatened to unseat him. Johnson had opposed additional funding for Ukraine before he was elevated to the speakership after McCarthy's ouster, but after multiple intelligence briefings and meetings with multiple factions of his conference, he emerged in recent weeks with a starkly different perspective. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. My son is going to begin in the Naval Academy this fall. This is a live-fire exercise for me, as it is for so many American families, Johnson told reporters on Saturday. Biden first requested the funding in mid-October, just weeks after Hamas attacked Israel. He called for the U.S. to stand with its allies in a crucial moment. Republicans demanded sweeping border security reforms in exchange for their support. A bipartisan working group in the Senate brokered a deal to include the most significant changes to migration policies in decades. But Trump, en route to capturing the 2024 GOP nomination for president, slammed the proposal as not sufficient. Johnson declared it would never pass the House. Senate Republicans voted it down, and the upper chamber passed the foreign aid plan without the border provisions in February. When it reached the House, Republicans again demanded border security provisions be attached to the legislation. They refused to advance the foreign aid bill for months as Johnson attempted to push the Senate to take up the House's hard-line border bill. The Biden administration's intelligence briefings and the change to a loan helped clinch the deal. As Republicans dealt with infighting in their conference, Democrats grappled with their own divisions. Some progressive lawyers resisted sending more aid to Israel, as its war against Hamas killed tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians and created dire humanitarian conditions in the Gaza Strip. I support so much that's in this. We absolutely have to provide Ukraine with aid. I support the humanitarian assistance that's in this. I even support the TikTok provision, Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat of Oregon, told USA Today. But the conditions in Gaza are horrific. I support defensive aid for Israel, but I cannot support sending more bombs when the style of warfare in Gaza is producing enormous civilian casualties and the restriction of aid is producing famine.
Lawmakers hear from kids and grandkids. TikTok measure prompts feedback from family. Congress on Tuesday took the extraordinary step of passing legislation to force TikTok's Beijing-based parent company to sell it or face an effective ban in the United States. The policy agitated many of the app's young users who showed up on Capitol Hill alongside lobbyists to push lawmakers to reject it. But for some of those lawmakers, the debate was even closer to home as they grappled with questions from their kids and grandchildren. Senator Todd Young, Republican of Indiana, said his four teenagers use it, which is something I'm not proud of or comfortable with. Per se, they actually get a fair amount of consumer value out of it in terms of interaction with their friends, social interaction, knowing what's happening, which can't be undervalued if you're a teenager, he said. But I try and explain to them that separate and apart from the national security considerations that we're having to weigh, they understand that. When the subject first came up in Congress, Senator Mike Rounds, Republican of South Dakota, recalled his 12-year-old granddaughter texting him, "Grandpa, can you vote for TikTok to not get banned?" He assured her they would take more time to look at the House's proposal. Weeks later, the vast majority of lawmakers in both parties and both chambers of Congress supported the company poses a national security risk. Informed by Biden administration intelligence briefings, they have raised concerns about the possibility of the Chinese government spying on Americans and spreading propaganda through the app. TikTok said the Chinese government hasn't requested American users' data and that it wouldn't hand it over if they did. They also argue that the legislation violates Americans' right to free speech and that banning the app would harm small businesses who rely on the app for exposure.
And that brings us to the end of this shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Teresa Whitaker and Lisa Horsch. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Lisa with our next article.
The Register's editorial opinion today is titled, "Lawmakers Take Wrong Steps on Taxes, Social Studies." The Iowa legislature called it a year a little before dawn Saturday, capping a week-long flurry of action on bills and amendments, some of which didn't exist 5 days before adjournment. In a few days, the editorial board will weigh in with a bigger picture assessment of where state government has been taking Iowans, but as an appetizer, we offer responses to five of those blink-and-you'll-miss-it developments from that final frenzied week. Social studies busybodying returns from the dead. Thumbs down. A plan to dedicate grade-by-grade topics for social studies failed to clear a procedural hurdle earlier in the year. Its language, with phrases such as the study of and devotion to the United States' exceptional and praiseworthy history, straddled the line between history and jingoism. A somewhat stripped-down version returned in an amendment to a curriculum review bill 3 days before the end of the session. Supportive legislators made clear during debate that they're pushing back against supposedly anti-American lessons in schools. Whether or not they have a point, this prescription is short on nuance, and that's not better. Finally, regardless of the content, education lobbyists are correct when they complain that specifying curriculum in Iowa code puts unnecessary burdens on schools and reduces flexibility without a good reason. 9 years of sensible progress income tax goes by, or progressive income tax goes by wayside. Thumbs down. Republican lawmakers stepped back from some bold ambitions they'd made noise about between January and April, but the income and property tax overhaul they hashed out privately and then passed in 48 hours last week has little to offer most Iowans. Lower-income residents will finally get a sliver of income tax relief in 2025. A few cities and counties will get a sliver of relief from budget restrictions put in place last year's property tax law. Those small benefits are no antidote for a wrong-headed pivot in Iowa's history, disproportionately favoring wealthier residents. The progressive income tax system that for 90 years has funded services using larger proportions of high-income Iowans' earnings will be no more. A raise for judges is welcome, but rules for schools are not. Mixed. A 5% pay increase for judges and magistrates was long overdue. Regrettably, rather than keep policy out of spending bills, lawmakers added to the education budget a prohibition on university diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. That bill also included new provisions for how K-12 school districts must interfere when students are chronically absent. That complex problem deserves attention, but this step is at best an incomplete one. The state will again end the year with over $2 billion of its revenue unspent, a fine practice in a vacuum, but frustrating in a state with obvious needs that are most easily addressed through state intervention. Important final pieces shouldn't be handled after bars close. Thumbs down. The final bill of 2024 was substantial. Among other things, it took tens of millions of dollars that would have otherwise been appropriated to area education agencies for other priorities. If this bothered you and you had wanted to make your voice heard, well, you would have needed to be in room 116 at the Capitol at 2 a.m. Saturday when senators opened the floor for comments from members of the public, minutes after the bill text was first published online. Just because the annual work at the Capitol routinely comes down at the session's end to rushed overnight bill passages doesn't mean it's a good practice. As for the AEA's lost funding, some will go to the new State Division of Special Education, and some will pay for raises for paraeducators. The diversions themselves are less troubling than Republicans' obsession with using cuts to offset spending on new initiatives, even in an era of large budget surpluses. The cherry on top is that when lawmakers wanted later in the bill to use $2 million to hire 12 Department of Public Safety officials to address the rise in illegal immigration, that money was magically available without a corresponding cut. And finally, hardest work starts now on mental health overhaul. Too soon to tell. Lawmakers completed work last week on several long-running projects, including authorizing educators to carry guns, reducing the number and authority of state boards and commissions, and reorganizing the state behavioral health and substance abuse systems. It remains to be seen which schools will accept the state's invitation on guns and how much public input will be lost through the board restructuring. The mental health overhaul could prove as momentous as any other piece of legislation in the session, but many months of follow-through are ahead in the implementation phase that will determine whether Governor Kim Reynolds' plan makes a big difference. This was written by Lucas Grundemeyer on behalf of the Register's editorial board. This editorial is the opinion of the Des Moines Register's editorial board, which includes Carol Hunter, executive editor, Lucas Grundemeyer, and then Richard Doak and Rox Laird.
We have a Your Turn guest column by Carol Spalding Cruz. Drake should preserve a comprehensive education. Welcome back to alums returning this week for the Drake Relays, and greetings to the wider Drake University community who take part in our annual celebration by attending track and field events, joining road races, and greeting friends old and new. For all of us who care about Drake's future, it's an important moment to acknowledge that, like many universities, a changing outlook for higher education leaves Drake facing unprecedented challenges. It's been a difficult semester for faculty. We navigated a compressed timeline for a university-wide review of academic programs, and addressed proposed program cuts that would eliminate accomplished professors of practice and tenured professors with strong records of scholarly achievement and teaching effectiveness. Fortunately, colleagues have breathed a bit easier in recent days as Faculty Senate voted on April 17th to retain programs in physics, astronomy, religion, and rhetoric, and graduate programs in accounting and public administration. Looming just ahead, though, is the final decision, which happens at Thursday's meeting of the Board of Trustees. Higher education faces many hard truths. An enrollment decline that started in 2010 will bump into the dreaded 2025 demographic cliff, which by some accounts will be accompanied by a national decline in college-age young people. These trends could lead to a drop in enrollment from which universities like Drake might never recover. It might seem sound business practice, then, to eliminate the costly investment in career lifetime positions that tenure represents. Indeed, according to a 2022 survey conducted by Inside Higher Ed, about 33% of university provosts no longer see tenure as viable at their institution, and 60% of academic administrators prefer alternatives to tenure, such as long-term contracts. These numbers suggest a gradual and possibly inevitable sea change for which higher education must prepare. As new educational delivery models threaten to splinter and diminish the traditional residential college experience, Drake will need more than a balanced budget. It will need visionary leadership from every level of administration as well as from our faculty. That's not going to happen by eroding our educational mission. One concern, among many, faculty felt upon undertaking the review process in good faith was that the number of majors within a program over time appeared to be the sole determining factor for elimination, without regard for enhancement of educational mission, a clear violation of American Association of University Professors guidelines. That's troubling. To be sure, our curriculum must adapt to students' educational needs in a changing workforce. But a curriculum is not a retail product line, and chasing trends is not our mission. A truly comprehensive college education can create lifelong passions students might not otherwise discover. In fact, some workforce analysts predict they're going to need it. Jobs once seen as unassailable in engineering, insurance, legal and medical assistance, finance, may be eclipsed by artificial intelligence. Future careers may lean into humanistic inquiry. I'm thinking about a neuroscience major in my writing seminar who recently discovered she is in love with big ideas. She has been struggling toward concepts she had not yet encountered that echo Plato's allegory of the cave from The Republic. I've shared it with her, even as colleagues in programs that ask the great why questions of language and belief, of material existence, of the heavens, fight to retain their jobs. It makes me realize how interdependent a comprehensive education really is. Eliminating an academic discipline is not just a one-off. It's a turn of the screw in our ability to deliver on our promise. Drake's Shaping Our Future website states that innovation is our way forward. That's why I'm inspired by the energy and connection I've seen in recent weeks as faculty from across colleges stress the importance of unity with the board, senior administration, and one another in seeking to increase revenue and cut costs. One colleague offered this excellent idea. Reserve a modest percentage of all unrestricted donations, 3% to 5%, for academic programs. As Drake nears the successful completion of a $200 million campaign, it should be safe to dream a little together. And that article again was from Carol Spalding Cruz, who is a professor of English at Drake University, where she has taught since 1996.
We have three letters to the editor. Our first letter comes from Bob Brown of Ankeny. More guns don't seem pro-life. It always amazes me when self-described pro-life people, like our governor, have an answer to gun violence in schools. Their answer inevitably is more guns to kill more people. So much for pro-life. I wonder if our kids will actually be safer from gun violence or victims of gun accidents. From Stephen Johnson of Ames, who welcomed new arrivals in 1989? who said these words in 1989. We lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and every corner of the world. And by doing so, we continuously renew and enrich our nation. Thanks to each wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we're a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world to the next frontier. This quality is vital to our future as a nation. If we ever closed the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost. The answer might not come as a surprise to today's Iowans. It was Ronald Reagan. And finally, from Dorothy Lifka of Des Moines, Iowa worst in the nation for nursing home care. Any measure of quality of life in Iowa should include how we treat the most vulnerable of our residents. The Register's April 20th story on nursing home staffing, titled Iowa Nursing Home Staffing Among Nation's Worst, Federal Data Shows, gives multiple examples of nursing home residents in need getting no care whatsoever, and in one example, being assaulted by another resident without staff intervention. Worst nursing home staffing is not a list we want to be at the top of. Governor Kim Reynolds opposes a proposed federal rule that would mandate specific staffing levels for care facilities that accept Medicare or Medicaid. What will she and the Iowa legislature do instead to protect Iowa's elderly?
Okay, and now we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'll start with sports on TV today. We have hockey, the National Hockey League, at 6 p.m. this evening on TBS Max. Florida is at Tampa Bay. At 6:30 on ESPN2, we have Carolina at the New York Islanders. In basketball, National Basketball Association, at 6 p.m. on NBAT, we have Cleveland at Orlando. At 6:30 p.m. on TNT, we have the New York Knicks at Philadelphia. At 9 p.m. following that on TNT, we have Denver at the LA Lakers. In Major League Baseball today at 12:10 p.m. on MLBN, we have Boston at Cleveland. At 2:10, following that, or maybe at the same time on a different channel, we have ESPN Plus and MLBN. We have Philadelphia at Cincinnati. At 2:10 p.m. on MLBN, we have San Diego at Colorado. And at 3:05 p.m., following that game on MLBN, we have the LA Dodgers at Washington. At 6:05 p.m. on MLBN, we have Oakland at the New York Yankees. In soccer, the English Premier League, at 2 p.m., USA NBCU, we have Manchester City at Brighton and Hove Albion.
And in college women's basketball news, Iowa's Clark is the first two-time winner of AAU Sullivan Award. This is written by Hassan Kasim. Add another award to the collection Caitlin Clark built at Iowa, and another first. The former Iowa women's basketball star, who went number one overall to the Indiana Fever in the WNBA draft, took home the 94th AAU James E. Sullivan Award in New York on Tuesday. She's the first two-time winner of the award, which has been handed out every year since 1930 to the nation's best athlete at the Olympic, collegiate, or similarly elite level. Clark also took home the honor in 2023. Former Iowa wrestler Spencer Lee is the only other Hawkeye to win the award, and he won that in 2019. The Sullivan Award recognizes leadership, citizenship, character, and sportsmanship on and off the field. Wrestler David Taylor, speed skater Emery Lehman, gymnast Frederick Richard, Texas volleyball player Madison Skinner, and para swimmer Noel Jaffe were the other finalists for the award. Voting on the award opened to the public on Tuesday, March 12th, and closed at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, March 19th, ahead of Iowa's run to the national championship, which was led by Clark. Past winners include Bobby Jones, Bill Walton, Carl Lewis, Janet Evans, Peyton Manning, Tim Tebow, and Missy Franklin, among others. Clark was selected as the recipient of the 2024 Wooden Award on April 10th. The award is presented annually to the most outstanding women's basketball player who achieves tremendous on-court success. Clark has also been honored by the Sporting News, the Associated Press, Women's Basketball Coaches Association, she got the Wade Trophy with them, United States Basketball Writers Association, who gave her the Ann Myers Drysdale Award, and the Naismith Trophy, among others. Clark is the all-time leader in scoring in NCAA basketball history, men's or women's, finishing with 3,951 career points. She led Iowa in the NCAA title game for a second consecutive season in 2024, marking just the third Final Four trip for the program in school history. Clark also reportedly signed an 8-year, $28 million contract with Nike, marking the highest paid sponsored contract for a women's basketball player.
Good for her. And we have a couple in brief articles here. Trust to return 2005 Heisman to Reggie Bush. Due to an evolving landscape in college football, the Heisman Trust is set to return the 2005 Heisman Trophy to Reggie Bush, ESPN reported on Wednesday. Bush won the 2005 Heisman Trophy in his final season at Southern California, where he amassed 3,169 rushing yards, gained 1,301 receiving yards, and returned kickoffs and punts for a combined 2,081 yards. He totaled 42 touchdowns and also threw a 52-yard touchdown pass. According to ESPN, the physical trophy is being returned to Bush by the Trust, and a replica will be returned to USC. Personally, I'm thrilled to reunite with my fellow Heisman winners and be a part of the storied legacy of the Heisman Trophy, and I'm honored to return to the Heisman family, Bush said in a statement to ESPN. I also look forward to working together with the Heisman Trust to advance the values and mission of the organization. In 2005, Bush was named first-team All-American and the Associated Press College Football Player of the Year. But he was stripped of the Heisman and his stats in 2010 after a 4-year investigation by the NCAA showed that Bush and his family took improper financial benefits, including cash, and paid for housing. When name, image, and likeness legislation was enacted in 2021, Bush asked the NCAA to reinstate his status. The Heisman Trust said at the time it would consider giving back his trophy if the NCAA agreed to reinstate him, but the organization declined. And then we have report. Lions wide receiver St. Brown gets $120 million extension. The Detroit Lions have agreed to a 4-year, $120 million extension with All-Pro wide receiver Amon-Ra St. Brown, NFL Network reported Wednesday. The deal runs through 2028 and reportedly includes $77 million guaranteed, supplanting Cooper Kupp's $75 million as the highest total among NFL wideouts. With an average annual value of $30 million per season, St. Brown would trail only Miami Dolphins star Tyreek Hill's annual compensation of $31.3 million, according to SpotTrack.
And now we'll go ahead and start, Dear Abby. Two daughters make clear whose side they've taken. Dear Abby, I have been divorced for 9 years. Before that, I was a stay-at-home mom raising 4 children. I had an in-home business, and most of the money went to our family's needs. My husband became an alcoholic 20 years into our 28-year marriage. After we divorced, my 2 adult daughters abandoned me because I received spousal support from their father. Whenever I let them know how much I miss them, the only answer they give is that they will resume a relationship when I stop taking the money. My younger daughter and I were close for years after the divorce, and then, all of a sudden, everything changed, and she ceased all communication. I used to have wonderful relationships with both, and they have since blocked communication with me and moved far away from me and their father. I would love to have a relationship with them, but everything is a dead end. If you're wondering, yes, the money is used for living expenses, help, etc. Please help. Incredulous in Oregon. Dear Incredulous, so your daughters have decided to side with their drunkard of a father and are trying to blackmail you into submission. Please, don't allow them to get away with it. Continue taking the alimony to which you are entitled and go on with your life. You can only hope that your daughters eventually will see the light. As I see it, you really have no other choice because at this point you are dependent on those funds to survive. Dear Abby, I am struggling with whether I am obligated to organize a party for our 50th anniversary. I was the main caregiver for my wife until a year ago when I physically could no longer do it and had to put her in a board and care facility. She has Alzheimer's and is wheelchair bound and must be fed and changed. I still work during the day, but I help put her to bed at night. On the weekends, I wheel her to a park so she can get fresh air and watch kids on the playground. She perks up when she sees me, and I always feel good when I can get her to laugh about something her goofy husband tried to do or botched. We have 5 grandchildren close by, and she has 2 sisters and a brother and many cousins. One sister visits her often. The care facility is small, but they love parties. Anniversaries are important, but as time goes on, they seem to just come and go. I feel like the luckiest guy in the world to have shared my life with my wife. I would appreciate your thoughts. Party or not, in California. Dear Party or Not, if you think your wife would enjoy it, arrange for a cake and beverages and invite the relatives. Before you do that, though, ask her caregivers if it would intimidate or frighten her to have so much activity going on around her. If it would give you pleasure to do this, you have my blessing. However, please remember that it is not an obligation.
Okay, and we're going to turn to the 50 states section. I don't think this has been read yet. The highlight, it's got a picture here in Iowa. The caption is, Altoona Mayor Dean O'Connor demonstrates how to use the first-of-its-kind boat launch at Spring Creek Park in Altoona. Altoona launched a first-of-its-kind amenity on Monday that got the mayor on the water. City officials staged a ribbon cutting for the new boat ramp and launch at Spring Creek Park. The launch is a track that jets riders in small boats, such as a kayak or a canoe, propel themselves into the water with handles on each side. The launch makes it easier to get in and out of the water, including for people with disabilities. Mayor Dean O'Connor demonstrated how to use the launch in a small blue kayak at the event. He said ahead of the launch that there will be future phases to add trails, fishing piers, and other recreational amenities. And out of Illinois, Springfield, as state lawmakers weigh carbon capture and sequestration regulations, federal officials are trying to woo support in Illinois, an area they see ripe for investment thanks to its geologic features. And out of Minnesota, in St. Paul, state regulators announced that for the first time ever, the water along the entirety of the river in the state will be monitored and tested by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency this year, NPR News reported. Out of Missouri in Jefferson City, after the program received a robust interest at the start of the year, the Missouri Senate unanimously passed an expansion of MOBUCS, a state-sponsored low-interest loan program serving small business, agriculture, and governmental clients. Out of Nebraska, Lincoln, city council members approved a land swap deal that would allow a $350 million prison to be built by the state, the Lincoln Journal-Star reported. Out of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, 55 people died in the custody of Wisconsin's prison system last year, according to newly released data. Of the deaths, almost half were deemed unanticipated, a description used by the State Department of Corrections that includes suicides, homicides, and unexpected illness. And out of South Dakota, Brookings. A new facility sending renewable natural gas made from dairy cattle manure to local energy customers could be the first of several such plants, a utility company said Monday while celebrating Earth Day, South Dakota Searchlight reported. And out of Topeka, Kansas, Karen, a 5-year-old female ostrich at the Topeka Zoo, recently died after grabbing and swallowing a staff member's keys, the zoo announced. And in Michigan, Detroit, Michigan has been cashing in federal benefit money paid to children in foster care to cover some of its own child welfare costs. It is one of 44 states that received an F grade because of the practice from the Children's Advocacy Institute at the University of San Diego School of Law. And North Dakota, out of Bismarck, a 19-year-old man has been convicted of murder in the June shooting death of a 16-year-old girl, the Bismarck Tribune reported. And finally, out of Indianapolis, school and child welfare officials failed to involve law enforcement after learning of allegations that a teacher orchestrated a Fight Club-style disciplinary system in his second-grade classroom. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Lisa Horsch. You heard from Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.